Miri. That was her name. And as long as Steve wouldn't be there to get all hot under the collar about him dancing with his sister's friend, why not go? At the YMCA, he'd have known all the girls, most of them, anyway, and they'd know him, dance with him, laugh with him, but none of them would feel the way Miri had in his arms. He couldn't explain it. He half hoped she wouldn't be there tonight, because he sensed he was just looking for trouble. She was young. He had to be careful, above the neck only, and only if she wanted him to kiss her. Only then. And there she was, in that red dress, and her mother's shoes making her 3 inches taller. And when it came to kissing, it turned out she was more than willing. Miri. Mason wasn't a secret love for long. During the 10 days of vacation, she saw him whenever he wasn't working. She was allowed to stay out until 10 p.m., as long as Rusty knew exactly where she was, a get-together at Robo's house or Eleanor's, or at the movies with Suzanne and Natalie and the other kids. Miri had to introduce him to Rusty, that was the deal, then to Uncle Henry, and finally to Irene, who'd had a conniption fit when she first heard his name, but not, thank goodness, in front of him. "For God's sake," Rusty said to Irene later, "she's not getting married. She's in 9th grade. "Be careful," Irene warned Miri. "All boys want the same thing." So do girls, Miri thought. But she was never going to make the mistake her mother did. She wouldn't go all the way until she was 23 or married, whichever came first. And they'd used protection, a funny little rubber circle called a diaphragm that you somehow had to shove up there, like Corinne used. Natalie had shown it to her in its circular container. "I'm not sure how well it works," Natalie said, "because I think Fern was a mistake, or maybe my mother got it after Fern was born." Last year, Robo had snitched one of her father's rubbers from under his shirts in his dresser drawer. They'd stretched it over a cucumber. "Do they get that big?" Suzanne asked. "Because if they do, I'm never doing it."
"Maybe we should have used a carrot," Robo said, and they all laughed.
Now Irene told her,
"Be a good girl. Promise me you'll be a good girl."
"I am a good girl," Miri said, "so stop worrying." Rusty didn't say anything. Mason. If he wanted to see her, he had to meet her mother, and not just her mother, but her uncle, maybe to prove there was a man around the house, and her grandmother, who looked like she'd swallowed a lemon when Miri introduced him and she'd heard his name. "McKittrick?" she'd said, like she'd never heard it before. He knew to shake hands with them. He knew to call the uncle, sir. Jack had taught him all that. He had no idea who'd taught Jack. He knew to tell them exactly what their plans were, and that he'd have her home by 10 o'clock, or else she'd call to explain. The mother didn't ask the questions he was expecting, starting with, "What do your parents do?" She didn't say, "Maybe I know them," like some of the girls' parents from the YMCA, so he didn't have to give his standard answer.
"I don't think so. No, you wouldn't know my parents. No, we're not new in town. I was born here at St. Elizabeth's."
He might not have told the truth if she'd asked those questions, so he was glad she hadn't. Miri. In the middle of vacation, Miri had an appointment at Dr. O's office for a checkup and to have her teeth cleaned. As Christina attached the bib around her neck, Miri said,
"You know Mason McKittrick, right?"
Christina was surprised.
"He's my boyfriend's brother. Why?"
Miri wasn't sure how to answer.
"No reason."
"Are you going with him?" Was she going with him? Did being in love for a week count? Christina didn't wait for her to answer.
"He's a nice boy," she said. "A hard worker. He wants to get out of Janet Memorial, and as soon as Jack can move into a better place...
But Mary didn't hear the rest of what Christina was saying. She was stuck at Janet Memorial.
It's temporary, Christina continued. Like I was saying, as soon as Jack moves into a better place, he'll be able to take Mason to live with him. In the meantime, you want to do something nice for Mason? Take his dog, Fred.
She had no idea he lived at Janet Memorial, the orphanage on Salem Avenue. He hadn't told her anything about his life, and she hadn't asked him any questions. But so what? She knew how she felt when they were together. Wasn't that enough?
Fred was a different story. Mason took Fred everywhere, except to work and to school. One day over vacation, he asked if she could keep him for the afternoon while he was at work. She'd told him, sure, without thinking about what she'd do with him. She couldn't risk bringing him home. If Irene caught her with a dog in the house, she'd be in big trouble. So she'd gone to Suzanne's, whose parents were both at work. She'd had to hold Fred in her arms to keep him from setting foot on the floor, or worse, jumping onto the furniture. In Suzanne's room, they'd made a little bed for him out of a box and some rags. Barking was off-limits. Suzanne lived in an apartment house on Chilton, where dogs weren't allowed. After her visit to Dr. O's office, she told Mason she'd had her teeth cleaned and that Dr. O had found a small cavity.
I have to go back to get it filled. He said I won't need Novocaine.
Mason wasn't impressed.
I've had teeth pulled without Novocaine, and it hurt like hell.
Dr. O would never hurt you.
That's where I'm going from now on.
They were walking home from the movies.
So I was wondering, she said, not able to stop herself, where does Fred live?
A shadow fell over his face. Why was she doing this?
He lives around,
Mason said.
He stays with one of my friends, but I pay for his food and I walk him every day. I can't have a dog at Janet, if that's what you're getting at.
She hated herself for putting him in this position.
I'm sorry.
For what?
That you're an orphan.
He forced a laugh and grabbed her hand, pulling her behind him as he ran. Elizabeth Daily Post. C-46 has a checkered history. GIs nicknamed the transport the Flying Coffin. By Henry Ammerman. December 26th. The C-46, the aircraft that crashed into the Elizabeth River on December 16th, began life with a bad name. It was rushed into military service in 1943 to fly supplies over the Himalaya hump from India to Burma. Allied pilots called her the Flying Coffin, with at least 31 known instances of fires or explosions in flight between May 1943 and March 1945. Many others went missing and were never found. Disabled C-46s were stranded at bases from Kansas to Karachi. It was standard procedure to save 2 of every 5 that reached the theater just for parts. The plane was gradually modified and improved, and in 1948, the Air Force made surplus C-46s available to airlines for rental at the very attractive rate of $300 a month. Here was a transport that could be modified to carry 52 passengers, enabling non-scheduled airlines to offer cut-rate service across the country and between this area and Florida in the winter. Despite the improvements, a summary of aircraft accidents shows 45 involving the C-46 between January 1947 and October 1951, 11 of them fatal, taking 137 lives. The need for careful maintenance is obvious, yet like any plane, it makes money only when flying. Miami Airlines, the non-scheduled operator of the ill-fated December 16th flight, is already in litigation with the Civil Aeronautics Board for flying an excessive number of flights between Newark and Florida.
but because the crash is still under investigation, it is too soon to say whether pressure to keep the plane in the air contributed to the disaster. Chapter 7. Miri. The fathers took turns driving their daughters to and from events, a get-together in someone's finished basement, a dance at the Y, a Saturday night movie. Miri was the only one without a father. Not that any of her friends asked about him. They figured either he was dead or her parents were divorced. Either way, they understood she didn't see him, didn't talk about him, and that was enough. Once, when they didn't know she was in the girls' room at school, she'd heard them speculate that maybe he'd died in the war. She sometimes hoped he had died in the war. That would simplify everything. Mothers might drive them somewhere during the day, but at night it was strictly father's. Anyway, Rusty didn't drive. She'd never had a car. She and Miri walked or took the bus around town. Sometimes Henry would give them a lift, but only in decent weather, because one of them, almost always Miri, would have to sit in the rumble seat. Ben Sapphire, on the other hand, drove a big black Packard. The car was new. It was the car he'd planned on driving to Miami Beach. Miri had seen photos of his wife standing next to it. Not that she wanted to see his family photos, but he'd brought an album to Irene's one day, and she knew Irene expected her to be polite. She couldn't tell him that when she pictured his beloved Estelle, it was inside the ball of fire that had fallen out of the sky. No, she could never tell anyone that. Well, maybe Natalie, since she claimed to have a special connection with Ruby Granick. But if Ruby knew anything about Estelle Sapphire, Natalie hadn't shared it with Miri. They'd held the funeral for Estelle 3 days after the crash. Irene had baked for the Shiva at the Sapphire's house in Bayonne, and now Ben Sapphire's sons were headed back to Chicago and Los Angeles with their wives and children. Once they'd left, Ben offered to drive Miri and her friends to the Y, or wherever they wanted to go, in his fancy new car. But Miri wasn't about to let him drive her anywhere. He was too old, too hairy, and sometimes, you never knew when, he'd break down and cry. It was dangerous to drive that way, wasn't it? She understood he was sad. She understood why. But she wasn't ready to accept a ride from him. "Thank you," she said to his offer. "But my friend's father is driving us tonight." He nodded.
"Maybe another time."
"Yes, another time." Ben Sapphire. He'd opened the door to the house in Bayonne, the house where he and Estelle had raised their family, calling out,
"Stelly, honey, I'm home."
But no one ran into his arms. No one slept curled around him, telling him every night before they went to sleep how much she loved him. Estelle was gone. Gone forever. He wanted to believe he'd catch up with her on the other side, but he didn't believe in the afterlife. It was all shit. Dead is dead. Dead and buried. All he had left was his memories and their children and grandchildren. He and Estelle had vowed long ago they would never become a burden to their children. The children had their own lives, and he wanted it that way. He didn't know what his future held, only that he had to get out of that house. He'd already made the decision to put it on the market. His daughters-in-law had disposed of Estelle's things. They'd taken the good jewelry and furs for themselves, with his blessing. The new leather gloves, gloves Estelle hadn't yet worn, they gave to Irene for the compassion she'd shown Ben since the crash. He could see Irene didn't want the gloves, but what could she do? She was a mensch. She thanked them for thinking of her. Now Ben would move to the Elizabeth Carteret Hotel until he found an apartment that suited him. In the meantime, there was always Irene's couch. After the funeral, he wanted to talk to the rabbi about something so personal, so shameful, it was eating away at him. But he couldn't admit it to this rabbi, who had bar mitzvahed his sons
who had married one of them. This rabbi, who thought of Ben Sapphire as a loving husband and father, a pillar of the community. Instead, he went to a Catholic church in Elizabeth, where no one would know him, and sat for a long time before he told the priest he had something to confess. He had not been faithful to Estelle. Men are different, he'd explained early on. Men have needs. And she'd understood. Not that she hadn't cried the first time, until he'd taken her in his arms and reassured her. I will never leave you. You understand? I will always be here for you and the boys. The others, he didn't love them. They weren't worth the hem of her dress. He just couldn't help himself, couldn't ask her to do the things he could pay for, things that made him feel dirty. She was his wife. Now he was done with all that. He'd been done with it for years, couldn't remember the last time. But there it was, gnawing at him, giving him sharp pains in his left side, as if he'd eaten popcorn and set off his diverticulitis. The priest listened as Ben explained he was a Jew, but too ashamed to talk about this with his rabbi. The priest was kind and forgiving. He asked Ben to think of others before thinking of himself, to help others before helping himself, to do good with the time he had left. Ben promised. He made a generous donation to the church and another to his synagogue. He visited the cemetery every day to talk to Estelle, to apologize for the things he'd done, to tell her she'd been his one and only love. If I could do it over, he'd cry, please, Stelly, give me another chance to prove how much I love you. But Estelle never responded. He stood alone, as the winter wind whipped his hat off his head, hoping for a sign, a falling leaf. A dove flying by. He'd have settled for a pigeon. But there was nothing. This was why he cried. Elizabeth Daily Post. Editorial. New Year, but Old Business. December 31st. We watched while giant machines of the air skimmed our rooftops in ever-increasing numbers. We warned against that inevitable day when disaster would follow in their wake. They said it couldn't happen. They said we were attempting to block progress. We watched as the last twisted wing of the plane that had claimed 56 lives was dragged from the banks of the Elizabeth River. We waited in vain for a solution that would make recurrence impossible. We are still watching and waiting. When will a concern for the safety of our citizens take precedence over a concern for the business of the Port Authority's Newark Airport? Chapter 8. Miri. Every year, Corinne let it be known that Miri was welcome to bring her mother to the Osners' New Year's Eve party. Every year, Miri explained to Corinne that Rusty never went out on New Year's Eve because New Year's Eve was when Rusty's father had died. I'm sorry, Corinne would say, but maybe this year. I doubt it, Miri would tell her. Not that she ever extended Corinne's invitation to Rusty. Why would she? It wasn't like the Osners and Rusty socialized. It wasn't like they were Rusty's friends or Rusty's second family, the way they were hers. Henry dropped Miri at Natalie's house on his way to pick up Leah. They were going to the Riviera nightclub in Fort Lee, the place where Frank Sinatra sometimes sang, where Martin and Lewis did their comedy act, and Poopy Campo and his band played Latin music. Henry looked dashing in his rented tux. Miri wished she could see Leah. Would she be wearing velvet? Taffeta? Would she look like Doris Day in I'll See You in My Dreams? Sometimes Leah had that Doris Day look. Other times she was more Debbie Reynolds, peeking out from under her bangs. When he pulled up in front of the Osners' house, Henry turned to Miri and said, "Tonight's the night," which embarrassed her at first.
until he dug a small black velvet box out of his pocket.
I'm proposing to Leah at midnight.
He opened the box to show Miri the ring. Miri felt herself choke up. She knew the ring. How many times had she gone with Irene to the vault when she was younger, to watch as Irene checked the contents of her safe deposit box, making sure the ring was still there, along with her diamond pin and her important papers. The ring and the pin were the only pieces of good jewelry Irene had left from before 1929, before the stock market crash, a different kind of crash from the one in the Elizabeth River 2 weeks ago, back when Irene and Max Ammerman still had money, before Max lost his fancy food emporium, before Irene sold the rest of her jewelry to pay the bills, before Max had the first stroke and then the second, the stroke that killed him on New Year's Eve, 1937, just weeks before Miri was born. Rusty named her for him. They always lit a Yahrzeit candle for Max on New Year's Eve, and another when the notice came from the synagogue listing the date of his death on the Hebrew calendar.
It's beautiful, she told Henry, and it was, a lacy design of small, twinkly diamonds.
Irene had always let her try it on, and even though Irene had said, someday when Uncle Henry finds the right girl, he'll give her this ring, she remembered exactly how disappointed she was at age 9 to learn it would not be hers.
You're the first to know, Henry said.
Nana doesn't know?
Maybe tomorrow, if Leah says yes.
Of course she'll say yes, Miri told him. If she doesn't, she's crazy, and you wouldn't want to marry a crazy person, would you? She hugged him.
Happy New Year, Miri. I hope someday I have a daughter exactly like you.
He ruffled her hair.
I am your daughter, Miri told him inside her head.
I know,
Henry whispered, as if he'd actually heard what she hadn't said. Then he hugged her again. Miri was not happy when Rusty showed up at the Osners' party, and even less happy to see she was wearing her good black dress, her dress shoes, and stockings with seams. Then there was the hair, Rita Hayworth hair, to her shoulders. Heads turned when Rusty came into the living room. She waved at Miri, but Miri turned away.
What is my mother doing here? She asked Natalie.
My mother wants to introduce her to Cousin Tukey from Birmingham.
Tukey? What kind of a name is Tukey?
Some family nickname. He's my mother's first cousin from the banking side of the family. You know, Purvis Brothers Bank.
Miri didn't know.
My mother's from the department store side.
Miri didn't know that either.
You should have warned me, she told Natalie.
How was I supposed to know your mother didn't tell you she was coming?
Corinne greeted Rusty and led her straight to a man who must have been Tukey Purvis, balding, not especially handsome, but not ugly either, with a mustache. Well, half the men in the room had mustaches, including Dr. O. She couldn't hold that against him. They were talking now, her mother and Tukey Purvis, and laughing, maybe even flirting. Miri didn't like it. She didn't know how grown-ups judged each other, especially how women judged men. It never made sense to her.
It's about character, Rusty once told her. Strength, goodness.
A sense of humor doesn't hurt either. She didn't ask how men judged women, because she already knew. It was obvious, and Rusty looked glamorous tonight.
That's not all of it, Rusty had once argued. But you're right. Looks are certainly a starting point. Chemistry, too.
Miri understood chemistry now. Chemistry turned your legs to jelly and made your insides roll over. If Mason hadn't had to work tonight, Miri might not be at the Osners' party. She hoped she'd never have to choose between her best friend and the boy she loved. Since seventh grade, New Year's Eve had been for just the two of them,
Natalie and Miri. She didn't think Natalie would have invited Mason. Maybe someday, when Natalie was also in love, they'd invite dates to the Osners' party. But not now. Rusty must have thought that Miri would be out with Mason when she accepted Corinne's invitation. Now she'd have to deal with her daughter keeping an eye on her. Rusty. She decided to go to the party at the last minute when Irene urged her to get out and enjoy herself. Seeing the worry on Miri's face now, she began to regret her decision. Maybe it had been a mistake to keep the men in her life a secret. Not that there had been many. But she'd never brought a date home. Not one man in 15 years. She hadn't done a thing to get Miri used to the idea, to the possibility. In all these years, there had been just 2 serious boyfriends. One of them had been married. She certainly wasn't going to introduce him to her family. She knew from the start he would never leave his wife and children. She knew she wasn't his first affair. Yet she kept seeing him. For 5 years, she saw him every week. If you asked her about him today, she wouldn't be able to explain it. Just that she'd been young, and she'd enjoyed the attention, the thrill, the sex. The second man was decent and available. He proposed after a few months, with a diamond as big as her thumbnail. For a minute, she thought she could learn to love him, could be happy with his promise of a big house in the suburbs, a maid to clean and cook, summer camp for Miri. But when it came time to introduce him to the family, she couldn't do it. They would see right through her. They would see the truth. She didn't love him, wasn't the least attracted to him, and didn't want to marry him, not even for an easier life. Sometimes she wondered about her first love, but not often. A girl gets in trouble. She marries the boy. They wind up hating each other, resenting each other, and finally they get a divorce. By then it's taken its toll on both of them and their children. No, she never wanted that, which is why she'd refused to allow her mother to call the Monskys and force Mike to marry her. Maybe she would fall in love again. If and when that happened, she would introduce him to Miri. But until then, what was the point? Miri. The Osners' living room glowed. The Hanukkah bush was gone, replaced by a fire in the fireplace, and at the Baby Grand from Altenburg's on East Jersey Street, Dr. O sat on the upholstered bench, covered by a needlepoint canvas, hand-stitched by Corinne. His fingers danced over the keys, never hesitating, the same fingers that worked magic in his patients' mouths. The guests were singing around the piano, glasses of scotch and rye and bourbon resting on coasters to avoid getting watermarks on the polished ebony. If anyone was careless, Mrs. Barnes was there in a flash, slipping a coaster under a glass here, scooping a crumpled cocktail napkin into her pocket to be deposited in the trash in the kitchen, where Mrs. Jones and her daughters, Rhonda and Jameson, were stacking up Sloppy Joe sandwiches on silver platters. Mrs. Jones was also the Osners' laundress, spending every Thursday at their house, washing and ironing the Osners' clothes, their bed linens. At the end of the day, Natalie's blouses, every one perfect, would be lined up on hangers in her closet. Never any last-minute ironing with the ironing board set up in the Osners' kitchen the way it was at Miri's, so that when you put on your blouse, it was still warm. Mrs. Jones ironed their pillowcases, the tops of their sheets, and Suzanne once told Miri that Mrs. Jones ironed their towels, but Miri hadn't believed her. Why would anyone iron towels?
I don't know, but she irons Natalie's dungarees, too. You can see the creases. And Corinne's underwear. I've seen her ironing Corinne's slips and nightgowns.
Sometimes, when Miri was ironing one of her ship-and-shore blouses, she pretended she was a laundress, like Mrs. Jones. But the one time she'd tried to iron a bra, it had melted into nothing. Poof! And her pretty blue nylon bra was gone forever. Miri and Natalie joined the singers around the piano. When someone called out the name of a song, Dr. O didn't hesitate. He moved right into it. For the first time, every song spoke directly to Miri. "He dances overhead, on the ceiling, near my bed." Yes, she thought. One day, you're a regular girl. 2 weeks later, you're someone in love. And wasn't that also the title of a song? When Rusty and Tuki came to the piano, Miri stopped singing. Rusty knew every word of every song and sang them too loud, smiling at Tuki, enjoying herself. Not that Rusty didn't sing in her room or when she was in the bathtub, but out in public? This was something new to Miri, and she found it embarrassing. By then, the dining room table was laden with platters. Not just the Sloppy Joe sandwiches, but a chafing dish of spicy meatballs in sauce, brisket sliced as thin as paper with white horseradish, cucumber salad, potato salad, and pickles. There were trays of cookies and tarts, and arugula from the Jewish bakery. Fern ran around the table in circles like a small, badly behaved dog, and if not exactly barking and snapping at people's ankles, then close to it. Mrs. Barnes tried to catch her, but Fern was too fast. After the buffet supper, the guests headed downstairs to the finished basement, where she and Mason had first danced together. She wished he could see it tonight, with gold and silver half-moons and stars hanging from the ceiling. At the bar, bottles of champagne sat on ice, waiting for midnight toasts. And the music. Instead of Nat King Cole singing Nature Boy, the jukebox was filled with dance music for Corinne and Dr. O's crowd, the samba, the rumba, and the newest craze, the mambo.
"You'd think Poopy were here himself," Miri heard one of the guests say, reminding her that Uncle Henry was dancing with Leah to the real, live Poopy at the Riviera. Miri had to admit, Tuki Purvis was a good dancer. The way he twirled Rusty but never lost control. The way Rusty was able to follow his every move. As far as Miri knew, the only place Rusty danced was in her bedroom, though sometimes she'd turn on the record player in the living room and try to get Miri to be her partner. As a little girl, Miri had loved to jitterbug with her mother, but not anymore. Miri preferred to watch Steve Osner dancing with Phil Stein's cousin, Kathy, who wore a dark green strapless velvet dress. She laughed a lot, and when she did, her dark eyes sparkled and crinkled up. You could tell Steve was gaga over her. Maybe she was gaga over Steve, too, even though she was a year ahead of him, already a college girl. Miri could recognize love now. Or maybe it was attraction she recognized. Either way, she knew it when she saw it. She could feel it when it was in the air, and it was in the air around Steve Osner and Kathy Stein. Natalie gave her a nudge. They were sitting on the steps leading up to the kitchen. "See those earrings my mother's wearing?" Corinne was dancing with Dr. O. "Daddy gave them to her for Hanukkah. She let me try them on. She said someday I'll find a husband who'll give me diamond earrings. Then she reminded me for the millionth time, it's just as easy to fall in love with a rich boy as a poor boy, which is interesting, considering Daddy was a poor boy who had to work his way all through school. She said, even though some people say diamonds aren't important, they are. I didn't tell her I'm never getting married."
"Since when?" Miri asked, surprised. "Since I promised Ruby my career as a dancer would always come first."
"Do you think you should be making promises to someone who's..."
She stopped herself just in time.
"I told you," Natalie said, annoyed. "She's not dead. She's living inside me."
"But what does that mean?"
Natalie shook her head. "You're not even trying to understand."
Miri wanted to understand what Natalie was trying to tell her,
For all she knew, it was possible. Just because she'd never heard of having a dead person living inside you didn't mean it couldn't happen. She'd read about spirits, about ghosts, not that she believed they were real. No, she argued with herself. This thing with Natalie was crazy. It was impossible. Natalie was going nuts. Maybe she should tell someone. But Natalie trusted her with her secret. If she told, she'd be betraying her best friend, wouldn't she? Or would she be helping her? Miri wasn't sure. This was a secret she wished she'd never heard. The conga line zigzagged around the room, everyone laughing as they 1, 2, 3 kicked. Dr. O led the way. Rusty was sandwiched between him and Tuki Purvis. Kathy Stein held on to Tuki's waist, and Steve held hers, followed by Corinne, then Dr. Reese.
Come on, Natalie said, dragging Miri out to join the fun.
They broke in between Dr. O and Rusty so that Miri held Natalie's waist and Rusty held hers. Not the way she would have planned it. Dr. O turned off the jukebox and switched on the radio for the countdown to midnight. Corinne handed out party hats and noisemakers, and as the clock struck midnight, corks popped, the guests cheered, and everyone started kissing. Miri watched Steve Osner kissing Kathy Stein, his hands on her naked back. When she and Mason kissed, they were almost always wearing winter coats. She tried to imagine how it would feel to have his hands on her naked back. Just that thought was enough to make her legs so weak she had to sit down. She was grateful her mother wasn't kissing Cousin Tuki or anyone else.
You don't have to worry, Natalie said.
Who's worrying? It's written all over your face.
What is?
He's not interested in getting married.
Suppose he falls for Rusty?
I'm telling you, that's not going to happen. So you can relax and wish me a Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Nat.
Happy New Year, Mir. They hugged. While the champagne flowed, welcoming in 1952, the guests told one another it was going to be a great year. Miri hoped they were right. Part 2. January, 1952. Elizabeth Daily Post. Investigation. Stewardess who perished in crash warned sister. By Henry Ammerman. January 8th. A highlight at the CAB hearing yesterday was a report that the stewardess on the C-46 that crashed on December 16th had telephoned her sister just 5 minutes before the plane took off, telling her that the plane was unfit to fly. She said that passengers on the aircraft's trip in from the West Coast suffered because cabin heaters had been inoperative. Joseph O. Fluitt, heading the investigation for the CAB, dismissed this as conjecture. He focused attention on a graphic presentation showing the course and probable altitudes flown by the plane. This had been carefully compiled from eyewitness reports and the locations of parts from the plane that fell to the ground. Experts on the C-46 have been brought in to examine the wreckage, with particular attention to the right engine, which had been streaming smoke. Chapter 9. Kathy. At Syracuse, Kathy Stein told her roommate, Jane Krasner, that she'd met someone over the holidays.
And I think, well, I really liked him.
They were on their beds with the pink and red plaid spreads they'd bought during orientation week on sale at Day Brothers. They'd become friends right away, decorating their tiny dorm room, figuring out how to share the only closet and the personal items they'd brought from home. Kathy's clock radio, Jane's foldable clothes dryer. Every night, Jane diligently hand-washed her heavy wool socks and woolite, along with her bra and underpants, and hung them on her wooden clothes dryer. Kathy collected her laundry for a week before using the washing machine in the basement of their dorm. Now, with finals coming up, They were studying, Kathy wrapped in the hand-knitted afghan her mother had made for her, Jane in her flannel robe.
"That was fast," Jane said. "Where does he go to school?"
"Okay, promise not to laugh."
"Promise."
"He's a senior in high school, but he's coming to Syracuse next year, assuming he gets in."
Jane just looked at her.
"He's mature for his age. Actually, we're just a few months apart because he has a winter birthday, and mine is November. So I want to get home for break after finals to see him again."
"You better make your reservations now."
"Come with me. I'll introduce you to my cousin Phil. He's Steve's best friend. We'll have fun."
"Where am I supposed to get the money to fly?"
"I'll bet my dad would spring for your ticket,"
Kathy said. Her father was an orthopedic surgeon.
"Don't do that. Don't ask your dad to pay for me. I can take the bus."
"But that would take all day and another day getting back."
"That's why I might not come."
"That'd be a disappointment."
"You're going to see a boy. You don't need me around."
"But it's more fun when you're around."
"Thanks."
"Wish me luck," Kathy said. "I'm going to call home now."
"Good luck."
Kathy went out to the payphone in the hall to dial her parents. Elizabeth Daily Post. Pelham girl has best posture. Cites muscular control. January 10th. The annual Posture Queen Award at Barnard College was given yesterday to Miss Marjorie Schulhoff of Pelham, New York. Freshmen were judged on the basis of carriage, poise, and ease of movement, both walking and sitting. Miss Schulhoff, a prospective art major, was also queen of the Columbia College rush last fall. She attributed her success to sleep, good food, and muscular control. "Exercise alone won't do it," she said. "I know plenty of football players who walk like apes." "You know," the newly crowned posture queen added, "I'd feel better if it was an academic award." Chapter 10. Miri. Usually, January was the longest month, dragging on and on, the weather cold and dreary, school routine and boring, everybody's noses runny, their throats sore. But this January, everything was different. Mason called Miri every night, sometime between 9 and 10 o'clock, whenever he got a break at the bowling alley. If she'd finished her homework, she might be watching TV at Irene's with Rusty and Ben Sapphire, who sometimes slept over on Irene's couch. Miri would leave the door between her house and Irene's open so she could hear the phone. When it rang, she'd run up the stairs, pick up the phone, and drag it by its long knotted cord under the bathroom door, locking it behind her. Then she'd sit on the edge of the tub in the dark, smelling Rusty's bath salts, lavender, citrus, musk, listening to Mason's breaths and her own, until she could feel him breathing into her ear right through the phone. After they'd said goodnight, she'd turn on the bathroom light and look at herself in the mirror on the medicine chest. Her face was always pink and warm. She'd splash it with water to take away the blush. Then she'd flush the toilet for no reason except to announce she'd finished in case anyone was interested, return the phone to the hall table, and run down the stairs to catch the rest of whatever TV show they'd been watching. Irene wouldn't say anything. Neither would Rusty. But Miri was sure they'd had plenty to say while she was gone, unless it was Wednesday and they'd been watching Kraft Television Theater. Then they wouldn't have talked at all, except during commercials. Every other Sunday night, Miri and Suzanne babysat for the Fosters, 7-year-old Penny and 4-year-old Betsy. Mr. Foster managed an appliance shop on Route 22, and Saturdays left him too tired to go out. It was okay with Rusty and Suzanne's mother as long as they had their homework finished and were home by 10:30. The girls liked it because it left them free on Saturday nights. Mrs. Foster had an impressive collection of hand-knit cardigan sweaters to wear over crisp white shirts, and this night her cardigan was in a cobalt blue and had brass buttons. She wore the same shoes every time they babysat, black pumps with medium heels. She was usually easygoing, but tonight she went over everything with Mary and Suzanne two or three times before leaving, while Mr. Foster, annoyed, checked his watch. She handed them lists with numbers of who to call in an emergency, including the Branford Theater in Newark, where Bright Victory was playing, and the Weekwake Diner, where they always stopped for supper after the movie. Mrs. Foster felt more secure knowing Suzanne's mother was a nurse, and she liked having two of them babysit, not just because she got two for the price of one. She said it was a comfort to her.
"Let's go, Joe," Mr. Foster called.
Penny and Betsy loved that.
"Let's go, Joe," they squealed.
Mrs. Foster didn't find that funny.
"I'll be right there, Monty."
"I'll be right there, Monty,"
the little girls sang, mimicking their mother.
"Stop that right now," Mrs. Foster told them.
And this time, they did.
"Suzanne and Mary have heard the spiel before," Mr. Foster called, tapping his watch.
"All right, Monty,"
Mrs. Foster said. Then, quietly, to Suzanne and Mary, "Betsy has sniffles. It could be the beginning of something, or nothing, but check on her every half hour after she goes to sleep, okay?"
"Okay, sure,"
Mary said, and Suzanne nodded. Mrs. Foster kissed Penny and Betsy.
"You girls be good." "Joanne," Mr. Foster called, and this time Mrs. Foster hurried to the door.
Once they heard the door close behind them, Suzanne let out a sigh. As soon as their mother was out of sight, the girls started racing through the house. Mary chased them, a game they loved.
"Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a tiger by the toe. Which little tiger will I catch first?"
The girls shrieked until Mary caught one, then the other, carrying them back to the living room. When they calmed down, Suzanne painted their toenails, and Mary brought them milk and ginger snaps from the kitchen. Later, when they were in their twin beds, tucked in just so, Mary and Suzanne took turns reading to them from a stack of library books. Mrs. Foster had been a first-grade teacher before the girls were born and stressed the importance of reading aloud to children. After that, Suzanne turned on the radio. Both girls took out the homework their mothers thought they'd finished earlier and settled down on the living room floor. Mr. and Mrs. Foster returned, happy, holding hands. It must have been a good movie. Usually, Mrs. Foster asked for details of how the evening had gone, but not tonight. Mr. Foster drove them home, each with $1.50 in her pocket, a bonanza. Now that the holidays were over, Mary was saving her babysitting money for her ninth-grade prom dress. She figured $15 would do it, including shoes. When Mr. Foster started humming a tune, Suzanne leaned close to Mary and whispered,
"I'll bet they went to a motel instead of a movie."
This thought had never occurred to Mary. Why would a married couple go to a motel when they said they'd be at the movies? No, Mary didn't believe it. She was sure Rusty would never do such a thing. Not that she was married. She didn't even have a boyfriend. And Mary liked it that way. Capricorn. Born on January 15th, you are a natural leader and problem solver. You have the intelligence to understand any situation and the discipline to follow through in pursuing a solution. Coupled with the trait of great loyalty, it makes you respected by all who know you. There is no better friend to have than a Capricorn. By the middle of the month, Fred knew Mary so well, he'd jump up and down, barking, the minute he saw her. She'd scoop him up, letting him lick her face. Unless she had an after-school activity, she'd meet Mason at Jefferson High and walk him down to Edison Lane's. Then she'd deliver Fred to Phil Stein's house, either walking all the way to Westminster or taking the bus if the weather was bad, hiding Fred inside her winter jacket, the way Mason had taught her. She loved having his little body next to hers. Phil's mother enjoyed Fred, so even if Phil wasn't home, it wasn't a problem. Mrs. Stein was glad to see Mary and always invited her in, offering a tasty cake or a piece of fruit or even a sandwich. If Mary accepted, Mrs. Stein would have something to eat, too, just to keep her company, laughing about whatever new diet she was going to start the following Monday. She liked flipping through her family photo albums, pointing out pictures of her dog, Goldie, who had died over the summer. "This is Goldie as a puppy, and here she is as a sweet old girl, a whole lifetime in 12 years. In one photo, Mary thought she recognized the girl in the green velvet dress from the Osners' New Year's Eve party. "That's my niece, Kathy," Mrs. Stein said. "A wonderful girl. She's a freshman at Syracuse." So it was Kathy Stein from New Year's Eve. Mrs. Stein seemed lonely to Mary, especially when she talked about her children. "I miss my daughter. She's away at college, University of Michigan. And next year, when Phil leaves, I don't know what I'll do." "Maybe you should get another dog," Mary suggested. "I've thought about that," Mrs. Stein said. "But what would we do when we travel? My husband is hoping to spend more time traveling once both children are at college." "Where does he want to go?" Mary asked. "Oh, he has some Meshuggah idea about adventure, about exotic lands," Mrs. Stein said, helping herself to a second tasty cake. "Maybe India, maybe Israel. Frankly, I'd rather see California. I'm not sure my stomach could handle India. I have a sensitive gut. You know what that's like." As far as guts were concerned, Mary knew only that certain foods, like raw tomatoes, triggered Irene's heartburn, and when they did, she'd drink a glass of Alka-Seltzer. "Anyway, my husband doesn't want another dog. He's afraid I won't want to leave a puppy at the kennel when we travel. It's true I never liked leaving Goldie, even when she was grown." She sighed and looked out the window. "It feels like snow, doesn't it?" "I hope it does. I'd like to have fresh snow for my birthday."
"Your birthday?"
"Yes, tomorrow. I'll be 15 on the 15th. Mrs. Stein brightened. 15 on the 15th? That's sure to be a lucky sign. You have to take every bit of luck that comes your way and turn it into something bigger, something lasting." Mary was mulling that over when Mrs. Stein touched her arm. "Come with me. I have something for you." "Oh, no, really," Mary said. "Oh, yes, really." Mary had never seen Mrs. Stein so animated. Fred trotted up the stairs behind them to Mrs. Stein's bedroom. Until then, Mary hadn't seen much of the Stein's house, which was on the fanciest street in town, where all the houses were big and old and set back from the street, surrounded by stately trees. She was familiar only with the back porch and the kitchen. But this, Mrs. Stein's bedroom, was bigger than Mary's living room and bedroom combined, with a chaise longue and two chairs grouped around a coffee table stacked with books and magazines spilling onto the floor, waiting to be read. At the other end of the room were two beds pushed together, attached to a single carved wooden headboard. Mrs. Stein disappeared into a walk-in closet behind the bed and came out with a small white box tied with a slender pink satin ribbon. She handed it to Mary. "Happy birthday." Mary was embarrassed. "Open it," Mrs. Stein sang. Mary half expected her to clap her hands and jump up and down. She seemed so pleased. Mary opened the box. Inside was a bracelet, gold with, were they garnets? Her birthstone?
But you can't give this to me. You should save it for your daughter.
Her birthstone is opal, Mrs. Stein said. Mine is garnet, like yours, and I've got more garnet bracelets than I can count. I want you to have this one. It's delicate, like you.
Miri had never thought of herself as delicate, and wasn't sure she wanted anyone else to, either. She supposed that next to Mrs. Stein, with her ample bosom, wide hips, and plump arms, she could seem delicate, but she wasn't.
Thank you, Miri said. It's beautiful.
So are you, Mrs. Stein said. No one outside the family had ever told her that.
Have a wonderful birthday.
Mrs. Stein leaned in and kissed her cheek. Fred barked until Mrs. Stein turned her attention to him. Miri was almost sure Rusty wouldn't approve of Mrs. Stein giving her a gold bracelet with garnets, so at first she didn't show it to her. But what was the point of having it if she could never wear it? That night, she waited until after Rusty's bath, when Rusty seemed relaxed and happy, humming to herself.
Mrs. Stein gave me a bracelet for my birthday. She said it doesn't fit her anymore, and she has more birthstone bracelets than she can possibly use.
Let me see that.
Miri passed her the bracelet. Rusty turned it over in her hand, studying it the way an appraiser might.
Which Mrs. Stein?
Phil's mother. They live on Westminster.
Who is Phil?
Phil Stein. He's Steve Osner's best friend. He was at the New Year's Eve party.
And what's the connection between you and Mrs. Stein?
I drop Fred off at the Stein's house a couple of days a week.
Fred?
Fred, Mason's dog.
Rusty breathed deeply through her nose. So this is about the dog?
Yes, Mrs. Stein likes having Fred around. They had a dog, Goldie, but she died.
Does that make Mrs. Stein a better mother than me?
What? No.
This wasn't going well. Mrs. Stein probably doesn't go to business, Rusty said.
She doesn't.
You see? Sometimes, no matter what Miri said or didn't say, Rusty acted as if it reflected on her as a mother. She should have told Rusty that Mrs. Stein would like to work, that she'd like to be a librarian or a clerk at a bookstore. Instead, she wound up saying what she thought Rusty wanted to hear.
You're the best mother.
You're just saying that so you can keep an expensive bracelet she had no right to give you.
I don't care about the bracelet.
Good. Then give it back. It's inappropriate for a stranger to give you such an extravagant gift.
She's not exactly a stranger,
Miri muttered under her breath, as Rusty walked away with the bracelet. Miri chased her down the hall.
Mom!
What?
You took the bracelet.
Rusty handed it to Miri. The next day, after school, she returned the bracelet. She didn't want to offend Mrs. Stein, but as soon as she began,
My mother doesn't think...
Mrs. Stein gave her a kind smile, a knowing smile, and took the box.
Maybe I will give it to my daughter, after all. I'm sure she'd like it.
She's hard to please.
Even so.
Thank you, Miri.
There. She'd done what she had to do. She would tell Rusty she'd returned the bracelet, and she hoped that would satisfy her. Rusty could be moody, but her bad moods rarely lasted. Before the family sat down to Miri's birthday dinner, Rusty gave her a small box wrapped in blue paper and tied with a white ribbon. Happy birthday, honey. Inside was a gold and garnet bracelet, not exactly the same as Mrs. Stein's, but close enough.
It's beautiful, Miri said, slipping it onto her wrist.
Now you see why,
Rusty began.
Miri hugged her mother. I'm sorry.
There's no need to be sorry,
Rusty told her, smoothing her hair. I love you.
I love you, too.
Miri would never know if